When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast, brought to you by Intelligence Squared.
I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative. Leadership is difficult but not complicated. In this podcast series, I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, politics, and beyond. My guest today is General Sir Chris Deverell. After joining the 2nd Royal Tank Regiment in 1983, he served in the British Army for over 40 years, ending his career as a 4-star general. Over this period, he led multiple organizations of tens of thousands of people, civilian and military, frontline and supporting, on operations and in headquarters. His most recent role was as one of the UK Chiefs of Staff and Commander of Joint Forces. During his time in the Army, he drove innovation at the Ministry of Defence, and since retiring, if that's the right word, Chris, retiring from that career, let's say, he's taken on a number of roles, including as a partner in a cybersecurity venture fund. Chris, it's lovely to meet you, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
You too, Chris. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for your time. Well, I don't think we can start anywhere else than with Ukraine, I think, at the moment, given how you spent the large part of your career. Would you say that conflict is unique in your career?
Well, I think in many ways it is. It's happening in Europe, and it is at a scale that we haven't seen before. I mean, so obviously there's been conflict, particularly in the Balkans, but this scale is unique. And you know, the risk, the danger, I think, is at a level that we haven't seen before. This is a very, very serious moment in history.
And so do you think the fact that we've, you know, ended up in this terrible, unprecedented situation, do you think that that represents a failure of leadership, certainly, let's say, in the West?
Well, I think you can look at this and say that over time, Putin's ambitions have been reinforced by our inaction. You know, you can say that, first of all, in Chechnya, then in Georgia, then in Crimea, the Donbass, and then in Syria, he got increasingly violent, increasingly ambitious, and we didn't do anything. Or didn't do much. And so you could, I think, describe that as a failure of leadership. But I think the reality is that it was extremely difficult to sense in any of those individual moments as you went along that you were right on the cliff edge. Whereas I think we can now see we are right on that cliff edge.
So that said then, how would you evaluate how the West has responded since, you know, in some ways, I suppose the unimaginable, I guess, happened?
Well, I think it's actually done pretty well. It has maintained a level of unity that people, I think, you know, remembering back to, for example, the world of Donald Trump and his presidency, couldn't possibly have imagined. If you think of some of the things that have been done, like the ending of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by Germany, or the closure of the SWIFT system to Russian payments. These were things that were completely off the table just a few months ago. And yet the West has come together and done them. So I think it has responded extremely well in the circumstances in terms of that achievement of unity, given how many distinct interests are in play here. You know, these countries are all very different, and they've got different politics, different parties in power, different individuals, different culture, and somehow the West has managed to draw that all together. And I think that is actually the center of gravity now. It's maintaining that unity. And it will be exceedingly difficult because for example, the sanctions will bite back on us increasingly over time, and it will be very hard to maintain them. But that unity is, I think, in the end, what we'll do for Putin.
And I mean, at any point over the past, not just 5 weeks, but 2 years, being a futurologist has been a slightly unforgiving game, but I'm nevertheless going to try you. How do you see, you talked about, eventual victory. How do you think this will play out?
Well, when I talk about eventual victory, I'm talking about, the long arc of history.
Yeah, right.
Which Martin Luther King said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I do fundamentally agree with that. And I think that over time, eventually, autocracies fail. But you can't be sure when that moment is going to arise. Because essentially what dooms them is the leader imposes a system where people only tell him or her what they want to hear. When it all depends upon the vision, understanding, and decision-making of one person, which is the norm in autocracies, eventually they fail. And you can see that repeatedly in history.
And I think maybe 2 years ago we all became eminent virologists or something like that. I think we've now all become amateur Kremlinologists, I think, haven't we? Yes. And I think we all are busy speculating about that point. About is one of the reasons we ended up here because he was being told what people thought he wanted to hear rather than maybe what he needed to hear. I mean, I guess to an extent, if we ever know the answer to that, it will be a very long time into the future from now.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable assumption, though. I think there's quite a lot of evidence to support that assumption.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you get into groupthink, and it's easier to get into groupthink in an autocracy than it is in a democracy. There are more voices in play in a democracy.
And do you think, then, if you were in your old job, and we'll come on and talk about your new jobs in a little while, but if you were still in your old job, or even, let's put it another way, the people who are currently doing your previous job, are they sitting looking at what's happening in Ukraine and revising what they think in terms of our, never mind what the opposition might be doing, but what we think about modern conflict?
Yeah, good question. So in the first instance, what they will be focusing on doing is helping Ukraine.
Yeah.
And trying to work through all the various different scenarios that might arise and to work out what the response should be. So, for example, were Putin to use chemical weapons, what would NATO do in response? So it is the current fight that will be preoccupying them now. They may have some discussion about what does this all tell us, but as a general principle, the military, I think, seeks to learn lessons at some distance from the event, not to do so immediately, because our experience is that trying to work out what has happened and what lessons to draw from it takes time and detailed study. You can't just dream it up. So I think you have to be really careful to draw conclusions. We need time and we need a lot of thought.
And do you think that military generally, but let's take it to the British military, given that's your specific area of expertise, although I'm sure you interacted with many, many others over your time. Do you think they are generally good learning organizations? I mean, the kind of the question behind that, I suppose, for me is that I think that, a lot of our understanding around leadership comes originally, I guess, from the military back over many centuries. Do you think the military or the militaries you've had direct experience with are good at that? Is that something that's institutionalized in a good way within them?
Yes, they certainly seek to be. Mm. And I would say the closer you get to a military conflict, the more they actually are. If you are fighting and dying on the strength of your tactics and your performance, it makes for incredible innovation. People often think of the First World War, for example, as being static trench warfare, but actually, if you look in detail at the evolution of tactics in World War I, there was extraordinary innovation from people who had to do it to stay alive. and to keep their people alive. So I think that that as a general principle, militaries are learning organizations. However, they're also not very diverse, and that acts against learning, I think. But certainly, if you ask military leaders about the characteristics of leadership, I think that most would say curiosity was a really important characteristic. And of course, you can't learn things without being curious.
I do just want to come back briefly to Zelensky. I mean, he is already an icon, I think, whose leadership will echo down the ages. I mean, I think that is nailed on. What do you think it is about what he's done that has made him a great leader? I mean, I know it's a difficult question because it's such a kind of an intangible thing. But when you look at him, what do you think lessons we could learn?
Well, I think the first thing to say is we don't really know very much about what's around him, you know, what the rest of the leadership team looks like. And there may be some amazing people in the rest of that leadership team that are really helping.
I'm assuming there must be because, I mean, you know, leadership's a team game, right, in all circumstances.
But in terms of Zelensky, I think communicated extremely well. I think that's a very important part of leadership. Communicate. He's offered clarity. You know, he hasn't complicated his ask. His ask is very simple, really, and he's kept on repeating it. You know, even though in some respects he isn't getting what he's asking for from the West, he's nevertheless continued to bang that drum. And I think his message is quite a simple message. He is defending freedom. And that Putin is not going to stop with Ukraine. So Ukraine is on the front line for democracy, and freedom isn't free. I think these are relatively simple messages. So that provision of clarity, I think, is a really important thing from a leader. And you can see it in other wartime leaders like Churchill, you know, some really clear and simple messages. He's obviously resilient himself. I mean, the pressure he must be under is just immense. His people dying, his soldiers dying. He's under personal threat himself. And yet, day in, day out, he's there demonstrating leadership. It's extraordinary. And that resilience is immense. And I think courage, you know, I mean, he's been brave. You know, so have his people. And we may be underestimating, you know, in seeing Zelensky as somehow this unique and extraordinary thing, we may be understating the significance of the Ukrainian people. Because if really what he's doing is representing this widespread resilience and courage amongst his people, it's a lot easier for him to do that.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he has an everyman element about him, doesn't he?
For sure.
In his manner and tone. And I also think the thing about him that's remarkable is the physical courage aspect of it that we're seeing. And this is not in any way to disparage great political leaders of the past, but he's literally right there in the middle of the fight as well, isn't he? And I think nobody would have thought it belittled him if he'd said, look, I think it's in everybody's interest if I sort of just move a bit further west. I mean, Biden asked him to, didn't he?
I mean, I think that line that is quoted, I don't know whether it's apocryphal or true, but the line, you know, I want ammunition, not a ride, is absolutely going to go down in history.
Go down in history. Because
I
it's
wish
not
I'd
just-
said it.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah, although I'm glad I didn't have to say it. Let's say that. careful what I wish for. Absolutely, because it's not just the content of that line. It's the way that line is delivered makes it already absolutely iconic. I mean, that would be a famous quote to go alongside all famous quotes in history. Absolutely. Yeah, well, I mean, I think we all have hold him close to our hearts, I think. So we're gonna go back. So we've evaluated everybody else's leaders. We've solved all those problems. So Chris, we're gonna go back. So you studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford. The favored by politicians.
Yes.
I think I don't know how many prime ministers. I don't know how many years.
Too many.
PPE. Too many, yes, exactly. So anyway, you didn't become a politician, you joined the army. What was, were you always going to, or, you know, was that ever since you were a little boy, or was it a later life decision?
My family tradition was public service. You know, my father was a civil servant. His father was a civil servant. Maternal grandfather was a judge. So there was no real commercial gene in our bodies. You know, it was all some kind of public service. So I didn't really, to be honest, consider a lot else.
And what of all the roles that you had during your long and illustrious career in the army, which was the one you enjoyed the most?
Depends what you mean by enjoy. I mean, the most stimulating.
Most rewarding, perhaps. Yeah. Found most rewarding.
Well, I think the most stimulating was definitely the last one. You know, I was a member of the Chief Staff Committee, which is six men. They're all men who collectively run Britain's armed forces. And that was a fascinating period, you know, right on the inside of everything that the military were doing. And also, you know, running a very large organization, 25,000 people in my command. So that at one level was immensely stimulating and interesting. Enjoyable? I mean, you know, I think back to life as a young troop leader with a troop of three tanks, you know, if you really want to find things that were enjoyable, you know, roaring around the countryside with the wind in your hair, that's enjoyable. Yeah. Working out how to make the budget add up is not, it might be interesting, but it isn't enjoyable.
No, I think that's true in most of our jobs. Only we also don't get the going around with the wind in the hair and the tanks as well. we don't get that part either. So I want to pick up on something you just talked about. Then you talked about the certainly when you were in that role, the six people that ran the military were all men. In an earlier episode, I interviewed Colonel Lucy Giles, who's the most senior woman in the British Army. What do you think the military generally can do in order to attract more women, more minorities, and of course not just attract them into the organization, but get them to the top of the organization as well? What more do you think the military can do?
It's a very intractable problem, and it's not that there isn't any will to fix it, because there is. Lucy, by the way, is not the most senior woman in the British Army. There are more senior women, but she did something very unusual, which was run a college at Sandhurst.
Oh, so, yes, she did. Sorry. Yes, that's my mistake.
So, you know, ultimately, it's a bottom-fed organisation, so it takes a long time to generate leaders. I had a 40-year career before I got to be, you know, a 37-year career before I got to be a four-star general. So it takes a long time to change.
You can't just go and hire somebody from McKinsey and put them in as a general.
Unfortunately, although they'd be no doubt absolutely brilliant at it, you can't. So you have to bring it up. I think the biggest problem that really is still an issue and unresolved is, what does the ideal career profile look like? Every organization has a master race, you know, if you'll forgive the horrible analogy.
They're rather unfortunate.
I mean, every organization has a function from which it draws its leaders. In the military, the senior leaders have been drawn from the fighting function, you know, not the logistic people or the HR people or the technical people. Historically, it's been drawn from those who close with the enemy. And there are reasons for that. You know, it's understandable. Yeah. If that's the most extreme thing we do, it's understandable you might want to have some people with some experience of that in senior leadership roles. But unfortunately, what it then does is, because those roles have only recently been opened up to women and are only, you know, not very many women want to do them or are successful in getting into them, we have a problem. So in my opinion, what we need to do is change that philosophy about what it takes to be a senior leader. We need to start thinking, as I think many other organizations do, that you can draw the strategic leadership in particular doesn't require somebody who knows how to get his bayonet out. You know, that it requires a completely different skill set. And we ought to prize logisticians and HR people and technical people and so on much more than we do. And if we did, they would then move up the ladder more quickly. And I think that is a remaining problem that needs to be addressed if the military is really going to get senior female and ethnic minority leaders.
And you've criticised in the past hierarchical information flows. Mm. So how does the military, or how do you think the military should deal with that, particularly given that it is almost the archetypal hierarchical organization? I mean, you literally give people orders. I mean, we have a hierarchy in our business, but we don't call each other sir and give each other orders. how do you fit those two together, both challenging hierarchical top-down, I suppose, information flows, whilst also maintaining a necessary hierarchy?
Yeah. Well, the answer is, I mean, you're right to point out that it's not straightforward. You actually have to, yes. You have to design for it. You need to, for example, when you're thinking about communicating down, you know, what I felt in the more senior roles I had was I couldn't rely on that hierarchy to communicate my message all the way from top to bottom. There were too many rungs in that ladder and too many possibilities for Chinese whispers or people who didn't agree with me not communicating my message. So I felt very strongly that I needed to communicate direct to what you might call the workforce. And to that end, I went to a lot of visiting units and did town halls where you stand up and deliver your message and then you take questions. Yes. I joined Twitter, which was unheard of at the time, and started doing my own Twitter. I didn't hand off the responsibility to someone else. I did it all myself. And, you know, so you find ways of communicating that bypass that hierarchy. That's very important, I think, in a leader of today. You cannot rely on hierarchical message delivery. But you also have to find ways of taking in information that is not dependent on that hierarchy in getting it to you. And that's about curiosity. And it's also about having really thinking about your sources of understanding. And this is something that I used to explain to people, and even after I'd explained it, they would look at me with bewilderment. But I'll try and explain it to you, Chris.
Okay, yeah, give it a go, yeah.
So if you asked me in those roles before, to put a percentage on my various sources of understanding, you know, how much understanding of the situation did I get from my staff? And how much understanding did I get from my superiors? And how much understanding did I get from the outside world? I used to say that I got about 25% of my understanding from the staff. And that used to horrify them, because they all do this immense amount of work. And, you know, they do this immense amount,
presumably.
In order to provide me with understanding.
Yeah.
But of course, the thing is, they don't know what they don't know. They are only as free to provide information as the constraints we put upon them. So we give them a frame of reference, we give them a hierarchy, we give them a way of thinking about the problem, and they duly present information that fits, that maps to that. So I got most of my understanding by talking to other people who had nothing to do with the organization, who therefore had a different framework, a different understanding. And that was really illuminating. I think that's a very important thing in a hierarchical organization. You have to be willing to go out and find new sources of understanding that are not based on your own system.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'd love to hear you talk about a bit is, I mean, it strikes me that the military, and, you know, a lot, like I said, I think a lot of what we'd call business organizational structure, mirrors or there's echoes between that and, you know, the original organizational hierarchies, which were the military. And yet what we try and do as an organization, and I'm sure what good military organizations try and do, is they need to find a balance between I suppose a balance between command, as in somebody somewhere has to make some decisions about the objectives that need to be fulfilled, and individual group or team or unit, I guess, in the context of the army, autonomy and free thinking and, you know, all those kind of words. And, you know, it seems to me that that great organizations find an effective balance between the two. You don't want total, like, everybody just making it up as they go along for themselves, but nor do you want some rigid command and control structure. How do you find that balance in, particularly in something as chaotic, I guess, as conflict?
Yeah. So I think you'd be surprised about one dimension of this, which is that there is a general assumption that the forces are extremely hierarchical and therefore dictatorial. In other words, I say jump, you know, and you say how high. But that's not, I think, the reality. I mean, especially not in peacetime. I mean, the armed forces, I think, operate by consensus to a much greater degree than many commercial organizations I know. However, you know, consensus is not always a good thing. It can, in particular, make change really hard to deliver. And that's the balancing, you know, the balancing issue with the armed forces is that there's sort of a homogeneity that it doesn't encourage difference. And that's a real danger. I remember going with a civilian boss to a meeting of some high-ranking officers in somebody's private house. So we were all in our own civilian clothes. And we sat around at this guy's table in the garden, having a cup of tea and talking. And my boss, my civilian boss, pointed out to me, he looked around and he said, "Do you know you're all wearing the same shoes?" Every single one of us, there were six of us, we were all wearing the same shoes. You know, and that in a sense is a a great visual explanation for the homogeneity that exists. And so I think the armed forces, there's lots of brilliant things about the armed forces, some really fantastic things, and I have never regretted for one second the career and the life that I've had. But there are definitely some things that hold it back. It to some degree it knows this and it's trying to change it, but it's not easy.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've worked in advertising agencies in Soho where everybody in the meeting has been wearing the same pair of imported Japanese jeans. Yeah. So I guess that's the advertising agency equivalent of that. So let's talk about now. You know, you've left the military, you've moved into the world of business. What are the most useful transferable skills, if you like, that you've taken across?
Age. Age comes, that means I've had lots of experience. A transferable skill. I think running a large organization at some level, a large organization is the same, you know, it's the same in advertising as it is in the military. There are some factors that just pertain, which are applicable anywhere. I think that knowledge of government is a thing that central government is a thing that is at a premium, and so that's been useful. I think that the sort of attention I paid to innovation in the last, say, 10 years of my career has been productive in the new role. But there are, you know, there are things about my new life that are very different as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, are the things you've had to unlearn, if you like? Different shoes?
No, I still wear the same shoes, I'm sad to say. I think I've had to learn, I had to have an enormous amount. Unlearn, I think, is a question I have to go away and think about. You know, there are all kinds of new things that I didn't know anything about that I have learned in the last 2.5 years. It's been a massively steep
learning curve. Give me an example of, you know, what, for example.
Well, so in the startup arena, you know, that whole startup model, that notion of, you know, a small handful of people with an idea, the availability of capital to fund the development of that idea, And then the multiplicity of business models that you could adopt to make that idea a success. You know, that's all very new to me, and I've loved it. You know, it is a very effective way, I think, of making progress, as we can see, you know, all around us. It's been massively facilitated by digital. You know, I don't think that it would have happened to the same degree without the fourth industrial revolution. But you know, I do think it is it's a model that big bureaucracies could learn from if they paid attention to them.
You've said that I think in the context of the military, but I suppose to an extent you could extrapolate this beyond the military, that they should be better harnessing, let's say, the power of big data. I mean, you know, yeah, too keen on that phrase, but we all know what we mean. Big data and AI to help determine, you know, determine actions, I guess, in life and death scenarios, but presumably beyond that as well. Do you think that could lead to the end of human, not the end, but at least the a significant evolution in the nature of human leadership? I mean,
I thought you were going to say the end of humans.
We started on a depressing note. We can't end on a depressing note as well. So
I imagine there will still be some constants that will apply in any circumstances, as far as leadership is concerned. I do think there are lots of things that AI does change, though, profoundly change, and we don't yet understand the degree to which it will profoundly change our lives.
Yeah,
but I imagine that leadership is always going to be about providing clarity. It's always going to be about setting an example. It's always going to be about the strategy. It's always going to be about resilience. You know, all of these things are always going to apply, I think, in any future.
Looking back on your military career, primarily given that's been the majority of your working life, what would you do differently, if anything?
I would have used my elbows a little bit more. I think I would have been more insistent that I knew what was right.
Yeah.
And less willing to work with this consensus.
I think that's a really interesting answer, because I think finding that balance between you know, consensus and I suppose taking responsibility, or saying, you know, no, this is, you know, I'm going to take a decision, we're going to go and do it like this, I think is a continual challenge for people in leadership positions, because if you're at either extreme, I think you're a poor leader. If you're just continually in a circular consensus, you're not really leading. But if you're just in the other end, you're sort of a dictator. You know,
yes.
we've already discussed some of the pitfalls of that, and finding that right balance.
If you want to talk about executing on strategy, you have to have alignment in the senior team. Mm. Because if you don't, they just consent and evade. They say yes and mean no. You know, I think this is there's a great book by Patrick Lencioni about the five dysfunctions of a team, which I think I recommend to anybody. It's about when teams don't work, and you know, one of the key dysfunctions is people actually violently agreeing but not saying so, violently disagreeing, sorry, but not saying so. I mean, and that is, I think, something I could have done better about if I was really honest with myself.
I'm sure that's one of the dysfunctions of a team. And I always think that one of the key things that effective teams need to be able to do is they need to be able to disagree without falling out.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really important. And by disagree, I mean, you have a real row. I mean, you know, teams should be able to be really passionate with each other without falling out. And then, you know, get to the end of that and go, anyway, right, okay, good. You know, let's go for a pint or whatever it is that floats your boat. I think, so I've got one final question, Chris. I've taken up a ton of your time. It's been absolutely fascinating. A question that is always a popular question is about failure. You know, we all have successes more. We all have failures, but what role has failure played in your journey as a leader?
Well, I think that there are definitely things I have tried that didn't work. And as a result, I changed. I think, if I'm honest, I always think that as I come to the end of a job, I think I'd be great at the previous job. You know, so I'm always about 5 years behind the times.
True, so
in other words, it takes time to understand, to process, you know, that the reason why that didn't work was, and now I could put that right, you know. So I think willingness to tolerate failure is such an important thing. And people say that, but often don't mean it.
100%.
You really have to mean it.
It's a really easy thing to say, but it's a really, it's quite a rare thing to do well. Yeah, I agree.
I think the final thing I would say is that, though, in this context, is that I'd much rather fail because I tried something and it didn't work than because I hadn't tried. You know, and I really have always believed that in life, that you know, I have a bias towards action, and I'm not afraid to think that way. I honestly think that that's an important attribute to, if you want to succeed in any career, it's having a bias towards action.
Well, I literally couldn't agree more. My fundamental belief about leadership is it is about getting stuff done. And if you're getting stuff done, you're not going far wrong, I think, in my opinion as a leader.
I agree.
And you just have to accept that some of that stuff isn't going to work out how you hoped it might and move on. So look, Chris, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks so much for appearing on the podcast.
Not at all. It's been my pleasure. Great conversation. Thank you, Chris.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to rate and review No Bullshit Leadership on Apple Podcasts. It lets us know what you think and helps others to find the show. Thank you.